This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's a reason it was included in the European Union's recent deforestation regulations. One of the six commodities included in that is cacao, because of the deforestation risk presented.
The new generation of veggie burgers do taste more like meat than their sawdust-leaning predecessors. And most agree that plant-based meat alternatives are a step in the right direction, considering the hefty impact that cattle have on the environment. But the Impossible Burgers and Beyond Meats of the world come with their own not-so-insignificant carbon challenges. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with environmental reporter Nithin Koka about his research for Vox on the impact of these popular plant-based meats on agricultural supply chains around the globe. We talk about the rapid growth of the market sector, take a look at how it affects the coconut oil and cacao butter industries, and while we're at it, get a snapshot of lab-grown meats as well.
I like to reggae, but you dance too fast for me. I like to make love to you, so you can make me scream. So
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Nithin Koka. He's a freelance environmental journalist based in Japan. Nithin, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be here again.
So you just submitted a piece for Vox.com entitled "Plant Burgers Are Way Better for the Planet Than Beef, But These Two Ingredients Threaten Tropical Ecosystems." So I wanted to dive into these two ingredients in a deeper way. You really uncover the problems that go into coconut and cacao agriculture. Why don't you start at the beginning in terms of these veggie burgers, these plant-based meats, and how the industry has evolved over the last few years?
Happy to. So I remember when I first heard about plant-based meat, I think it was at an event like 5 or 6 years ago, and there was like a big marketing push by these companies, Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, to come to these environmental and journalism conferences and kind of push this as a more sustainable alternative to animal agriculture. And it was, I think, when I was in 2019, I was doing several reporting on coconut in Southeast Asia, looking at kind of issues that farmers are facing. And my editor at the publication at the time asked me to like look into what are the key companies that are using coconut oil. And I came across the fact that they're a key ingredient in both Beyond and Impossible's burgers. And I thought that was super interesting because they're basically shifting to sourcing an ingredient that only grows in the tropics and only grows in regions where there's high levels of biodiversity and forests. And I was concerned, like, if plant-based meat grows to the scale they want to, because, you know, if you look at the projections, they want to expand by 10 to 20 times in just 5 or 10 years to rapidly displace animal meat and hopefully and transform our food system to one that they argue is more sustainable. If that's the case, there's going to be a lot more coconut oil. And as I discovered later, cacao butter is an ingredient in Beyond's products. So anytime we have a food shift, anytime we kind of like change how we do something, there's going to be impacts across the supply chain. And what I was curious about is if plant-based meat does take off to the scale it does, and if we start consuming more of these plant-based meat burgers from both Beyond Impossible and other companies, how is that going to impact these tropical supply chains for ingredients that have key deforestation, biodiversity, and also, you know, labor and social risks in Southeast Asia? That's where the idea came from.
How tied to these two oils are the industry? Can they use other types of oils, or is it's either cacao or coconut?
Yeah, it's a good question. So as I learned, like, cacao and coconut are pretty unique. They're both solid at room temperature, which is similar to animal fat. So if you're trying to create a product that mimics animal fat, animal meat in the same way, you want to use ingredients that kind of mimic those qualities. And cacao butter and coconut oil are two quite unique plant-based oils because they have high burning points. So they allow for things like the grilling sensation when you try to grill a plant-based burger, and they wanted to, you know, the companies want to make it easily replaceable for cooks and chefs and home cooks to like use in grills at home in ways that exactly mimic regular meat.
So they want it to be greasy to what we're used to tasting with a greasy hamburger, that grease, but not like a mess.
Yeah, exactly. So like other oils, like, you know, the typical oils we use in the U.S., like sunflower oils and canola oil, they are liquid at room temperature. They don't have the same kind of like consistency as coconut oil or cacao butter. So they won't give the same type of texture. They won't have the same kind of feel, mimic the same kind of
mouthfeel.
Yeah. So there aren't any really good replacements for these two. I think some companies are looking into synthetic oils, basically like lab created oils. I think the challenge for Beyond and Impossible, and especially, I think especially Beyond, because they really kind of push that they're not GMO, versus Impossible has that kind of, they use some GMO, genetically modified ingredients. They're both pushing for their products to be natural and as natural as possible. They don't want to, they're concerned that people are worried about too many artificial or lab created ingredients. And I think they're going to be really reticent to use a lab created oil. And also the fact is like these lab created oils might be very expensive. They might also have their own environmental or energy impacts. So they're quite untested and unclear. So at the time, these are the two best ingredients for them to create that kind of fatty quality necessary for their products to be, as they claim, to be just like meat, but not be meat.
One of the first characters you profile in this Vox piece is a farmer who was a longtime cacao butter farmer who was shocked to learn that his product is actually being used in burgers around the world.
Yeah, so for this trip, I got funding from the McGraw Center for Business Journalism, so I was able to travel to some of the farming regions in Southeast Asia, which is a real great opportunity to kind of get, you know, be able to meet people in the field and get to understand their stories. So I connected with, I went to Sulawesi, which is in East Indonesia, and it's one of the major cacao butter and cacao bean growing regions in the world. I think the largest outside of Africa. And I'd like identified that actually most cacao butter exported to the U.S. is coming from Indonesia, not from West Africa. So Jalil was had been farming, I believe, for more than 20 years. He took me to his farm, showed me like what was going on. And when I asked him, like, do you know where your cacao goes to? And I asked this to several farmers. He had no idea. And most farmers had no idea because farmers are one of the supply chain and they, you know, sell to a middleman. And it just goes off into some abyss, and they don't know like who's using it or how it's ending up. And plant-based meat, Beyond Meat, these burgers, these products were completely unknown to him. He had no idea that plant-based meat existed. He had never heard of these companies before. He had no idea that you could take cacao butter and use it in, you know, different types of products. He assumed everything was just for chocolate, but he really didn't know. And I think that's it kind of illuminates something about supply chains, that the people producing the products, the ingredients for the goods that we use, usually have no idea like how their ingredients are being used in these complex, diverse ways and how they're flowing around the world, which I think is a big problem.
And what did you learn about the stresses of the supply chain that are being created by the popularity of these plant-based meats?
Yeah, so at this stage, like the industry is still relatively small, so it was hard to identify like specific like supply risks that are happening just because of demand from plant-based meat. What we identified more is like, you know, if growth gets to a stage where it will in the future, there will be a lot of very potential large amounts of coconut oil and cacao butter being used for plant-based meat. I think the projection I saw was by 2030, something like 19% of global coconut oil could end up just being used for plant-based meat, which is a humongous amount coming from now, probably like 1% to 2%.
That's a tough projection also when you consider how popular those two commodities are for a lot of other things that are gaining in popularity. Like I know people are cooking with coconut oil a lot more and they put it in their coffee, that bulletproof coffee. And then chocolate, dark chocolate in particular, has gotten more popular. And I know that there's been some real supply chain issues with cacao beans, correct?
Yeah, there's lots of challenges along these supply chains, especially cacao. I think has gotten a lot of attention because of child labor concerns and deforestation in Africa specifically. I guess one thing that really surprised me, and I didn't expect when I went to the field, is that I thought because of these things you mentioned, like the popularity of cacao, the popularity of coconut oil, that farmers would be, you know, doing well, that they'd have a lot of demand for their goods and that there's a strong market. And actually, I saw the opposite in both the Philippines and Indonesia. The market for these products was really weak, and a lot of farmers were switching to other products or cutting down their coconut trees. Jalil, three of his four neighbors that used to all grow cacao had switched to rice because they were getting subsidized to do rice from the government, and they found it to be a more profitable venture than doing cacao. He had stuck to cacao because he felt some sort of kind of connection to his plants and his farm, because he had inherited from his family and had been doing it for quite a while. But he was, you know, he definitely expressed sadness that his neighbors no longer want to grow cacao, and that cacao production in that part of Sulawesi has been dropping. And I think this is a big concern for the plant-based meat industry, because if they want to grow 10 to 20 times in 10 to 15 years, but there is a lot of farmers who are abandoning their cacao butter and coconut oil farms, is there going to be enough of these products for them to actually meet those projections? And are they able to do it, or are they going to have to pay a lot more? And then they're going to have challenges meeting price parity with meat, which is a key goal of both of the companies, because they see the future growth in the market being when they can be cost competitive. When you go to the grocery store and buying their product is the same as buying a beef hamburger, they think that's going to really drive a lot of growth. But the only way to get to that is reduce costs. And if you don't have, you know, access to good and cheap ingredients, it's going to be really hard to reduce costs.
Thirsty at the fountain, no water there can slake. Dance round in the ring again, forgive the new mistake. Conscious of my cheeseburger, most mindful of my shake. Suddenly I hear my intuition start to quake, so I wash it down, wash it down, wash it down. When the reader is the poem, then just leave love alone. In a wink of eternity, I find myself a home. Better be my own circumstance to the unknown. Suddenly I hear my intuition start to groan, and I wash it down, wash it down, wash it down.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to environmental journalist Nithin Koka. So Nithin, you just mentioned comparing this to hamburgers in terms of the marketplace. Can we do an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of carbon emissions or methane emissions? What's your feeling after studying this in depth? Are plant-based meats a promising alternative to beef and pork and other animal meats? Or we're going to look back at this as a flash in the pan, no pun intended?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's been quite a few like life cycle analyses being published that kind of like try to compare the greenhouse gas, water, land use impacts of plant-based meat compared to traditional animal agriculture. And most of the studies are pretty clearly show that plant-based meat will have much lower greenhouse gas emissions, use less water. And then they also argue that it'll use less land. And I think most of the arguments are pretty clear, because I think animal agriculture, especially industrial production in the U.S. and in the global north, is very intensive and very bad for the environment. So I think there isn't really a case to say like that plant-based meat. I think the science there is pretty clear and pretty unequivocal. I think though what I was like concerned about is like anytime you have a shift in supply chains, you're going to have like environmental impacts in certain regions. So like in Southeast Asia, I think we're really understanding like globally, like tropical landscapes are really important for climate, for biodiversity. They host so much more carbon stock. They host a lot more animal and plant species than any other landscape. So these landscapes deserve like particular protection because of the role they play. And if we're displacing animal agriculture production in the US, in the Midwest, to these coconut and cacao farmers in Southeast Asia, there's a risk of unintended consequences that have, you know, effects in these landscapes that are particularly important globally. So I think that's the area where I think there's not enough attention being paid, and we need to like look a little bit more. That's not to say like that means that plant-based meat is worse than animal meat, but it's saying that there's a real risk of impacts along supply chains in Africa, in Southeast Asia, that could be really negative. And I think we need to understand those risks and how to make sure we can mitigate them and maybe find ways to avoid exacerbating social environmental harms along these in these very critical tropical regions.
So when we look at tropical oil problems in Southeast Asia, we've often been focusing on palm oils. Mm-hmm. But coconut and cacao are slightly different, right? Are they still presenting themselves with the same set of environmental challenges that we look at with a tropical palm oil in terms of the degradation that can accompany
monocultural agriculture practices.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. It's something I was curious about too, especially for coconut oil, since it's being kind of presented. You see it in the U.S. as people are switching to coconut oil from palm oil because they've seen all of these stories about the negative impacts of palm oil production in Southeast Asia,
right.
The deforestation, the fires, some horrible human rights and social risks.
And it's also marketed in the U.S. similar to like olive oil. You see like the organic virgin coconut oil. It's a very wide range for these products in terms of pricing. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, it's true. What I found like with coconut specifically, and cacao is very different, so I'll talk about cacao a little bit later. But with coconut, like it's actually in Southeast Asia, and I think also in India and the Pacific, it's a heritage crop. It's actually been growing there for, you know, generations. It's often in these multi-crop settings grown by smallholders. I think 98% is grown by farmers who have less than 10 hectares. Oil palm is like, you know, 50 to 60% is grown by these gigantic monoculture plantations owned by big companies. So it's a very, very different type of production scale. Because coconut oil integrates with the landscape better, palm oil, you know, is not from Southeast Asia. It's a non-native crop bought by the Dutch and the British during colonial era. And it actually, that's one of the reasons it caused a lot of problems, because it's in conflict with the landscape. You drain the soil, you have to like change the kind of water system to grow palm oil, whereas coconut oil integrates very well because it's always been growing in that area. So I didn't see the same level of, you know, deforestation impacts. Looking at coconut oil, I definitely encountered a lot of, I think, concerns about labor and livelihoods. A lot of farmers that are struggling, not making enough money. You know, a couple of people mentioned the risk of human trafficking, because some of these villages in rural areas are so poor that human traffickers would come and like kind of take advantage of these farmers, predatory loans, suicide. So I think there's a lot of other issues with coconut oil. With cacao butter, there is like a much clearer evidence of deforestation risk, particularly in Africa. Because of the growing demand for cacao and cacao butter. And I think in Southeast Asia as well, in Sulawesi, like when the industry grew in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of deforestation that took place. And there are still key risks of deforestation. And one thing that came up is that because climate change is changing the landscape, changing the areas where cacao can grow productively, farmers are being encouraged to push into areas like higher elevation where it's a little bit cooler and cacao can be more productive. So because of that incentive is to kind of shift crops. You know, the place I saw where they had shifted from cacao to rice could be displaced by somewhere else, someone shifting from tropical forest to cacao. So there is a real deforestation risk for cacao, and there's clear evidence in West Africa that cacao plantations have expanded into the Congo, into tropical forested regions. And it's actually, there's a reason it was included in the European Union's recent deforestation regulations. One of the six commodities included in that is cacao because of the deforestation risk presented.
And from a taste perspective, I know that like coffee beans, cacao beans are marketed at least as regional. You know, you'll see like chocolate from Costa Rica or chocolate from Kenya. I'm not aware of that in the coconut marketplace. Does that exist? Is there a big difference between regions?
Yeah, I think you have to look at it like, I guess like the very, very niche market for like virgin coconut oil and the kind of high-end product you see in like kind of health stores like Whole Foods. I think those products are probably, it's a tiny segment. I think it's probably like 1% of global coconut oil production is actually for those kind of virgin coconut oil products.
I don't know. Things have changed. You've been away for a little bit, but I was just at Costco and there was these huge tubs of extra virgin organic coconut oil at ridiculously low prices. So I think the market is shifting just in the last year or two here in the U.S.
Yeah, well, actually, it did come across in my reporting, like people told me that the coconut oil, virgin coconut oil boom is kind of faded in the West. So they told me like 5-6 years ago, there was like a strong demand. It was seen as a health conscious product. In the last 4 or 5 years, they told me it's really kind of dropped, and that people who create, especially the ones I spoke to that do this in a more ethical, sustainable way and with traceability, they're having a harder time finding purchasers because they can just replace it with the cheaply produced virgin coconut oil. I guess like the other 99% of coconut oil is what's called RBD coconut oil, and it's just a processed product that's completely, everything is mixed up together. There's no differentiation. It's actually like sold at the same markets as palm oil or sunflower oil. And that's the product that's going into plant-based meat, not the virgin coconut oil. That's kind of a niche product that's kind of just going to Western markets.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to environmental journalist Nithin Koka. So, Nithin, turning to some of the alternatives to alternative meats, let's look at lab-grown meats and the threat that plant-based meats might face from the introduction of lab-grown meats to menus across the world eventually. We are just talking about the price points and the thin margins that farmers have in Southeast Asia and in other parts of the world where they grow cacao and coconut oils. Do we see, let's turn to lab-grown meats and see how that might play out for this industry.
Yeah, I'm deeply curious. I think a lot of people are quite curious. Lab-grown meat, I mean, it just got approved in the U.S. I think two products got approved last week, which is pretty historic. And then when I was in Singapore for a conference, a plant-based meat conference, Singapore was the first country in the world to have a lab-based meat product approved that you can actually purchase, but only at a very expensive gourmet restaurant, and you had to make reservations several weeks in advance. So it's really, I think it's quite far from being available commercially. I have a lot of questions. There are concerns, and I've seen a couple of life cycle analyses that show that lab-based meat is so energy intensive because it requires a lot of energy for production that it will not have the same environmental benefits as plant-based meat. The companies argue that with economies of scale and like technological innovation that they'll be able to reduce the energy input, but it's a question because it's not proven that they can. So the environmental benefits may not be as strong. If that's the reason people are switching to plant-based meat, lab-grown meat may not provide those same type of benefits for climate, for land. And the second question is lab-grown meat still needs input. They still need ingredients. You still need something to be used in the lab to create the product. So I'm curious, where are they going to be sourcing their ingredients for? What are their ingredients? Is it because they're not going to create it from air? Is it going to be electricity or energy? Is it going to be some other synthetic material? Is it going to be soy? Or is it going to be coconut oil? Is it potentially going to be using the same type of things? Or are they going to use these synthetic oils? So there's a lot of questions about how lab-grown meat will impact the supply chain. I think it's too early to say much about it yet because it's I think it's still several years away until we'll start seeing it in grocery stores and start seeing, kind of getting these life cycle analyses and understandings of what actually the science behind these things and their potential sustainability and environmental impacts.
Well, aren't the substrates often just animal cells that they're cloning, or is it different than that? Are they putting together something similar to a plant-based meat, but using animal cells?
Yeah, I think there's quite a range. So the product that's approved in Singapore is actually it's a hybrid product. So they use some animal cell using the process you mentioned mixed with a plant-based ingredients. So it's actually not 100% lab-grown meat. And it sounds like quite a few of the products will actually be more likely to be something like that. Maybe getting the animal tissue or the protein part from a lab-grown product, but also kind of mixing it with other ingredients to kind of create the texture. So it'll be interesting to see how they actually end up with the final formulas that they'll use. But I guess even for even if they're cloning these cells in a laboratory, they still have to provide something for the cells to kind of, absorb to be cloned. So they still need to provide some sort of energy input or some sort of input for the laboratory. So I'm curious where they're going to be sourcing their inputs from. Where are they going to be getting the protein, the raw protein material to actually make those cells? And where is that coming from? I'm curious about that side because it's not quite clear. I don't see them mentioning it much.
I'm also curious how the vegan community will approach the ethical dilemma that a lab-grown meat could present to oneself. And I guess the bigger question from an industry perspective would be India, which is kind of the holy grail for the beef industry. Do we know how the Indian marketplace would view lab-grown meat? Can everybody eat this?
It's complicated. So, I mean, I was looking mostly at my focus as a journalist is mostly on sustainability and in kind of environmental effects and supply chains. So I was kind of focusing on that angle in the story. Mm-hmm. But I do know there are, segments of the vegan population that are really focused on animal welfare. And I think for them, a lab-created product is fine because they're really concerned about how the health of animals in industrial agricultural systems. Versus I think for other vegans that had to take a different approach, it may not work. I did look a little bit at the scale of plant-based or meat alternatives in Asia, in Southeast Asia and South Asia, and at this stage, like, even plant-based meat hasn't yet really been introduced into those markets. Like, Singapore is an exception, but, like, Indonesia, the Philippines, India, there's very little, beyond an impossible, for example, they're not really producing products for those countries. So it's hard to know, like, what impact lab-grown meat would have when we have not even, like, seen how plant-based meat is going to be accepted by those countries, places like India. And there's this other side, like, a lot of the products being created by these companies are really, like, Western-oriented. You know, Impossible and Beyond, their first product was a hamburger alternative. And then they're kind of been kind of shifting to other things that kind of are really part of the Western palate. But in Asia, like, the way meat products are used is quite different. There are, like, a lot of Asian startups that are trying to, like, create products that are more, like, for, you know, India or Southeast Asian palates and kind of, like, mimic how meat is used in those countries and those diets. But so far, they're all quite small. I don't think, as this industry grows, there's a lot of questions and things we have to see. Something that came up also, like, these plant-based meat companies had the same rush 5-6 years ago. They wanted to be the first ones to create the product. So sometimes I think they put out a product that wasn't that good at the beginning. And then a lot of people tried, you know, they tried one plant-based meat burger and it wasn't that good. And then they don't want to try again because they had it once. So there's a question, do you want to be the first? Or does the industry need to, like, wait until you have something that's really good and then release that? And then you might be able to get more skeptical people to enjoy it. It's a difficult question. So I think right now, because of this kind of, it's, you know, the feeling I get from the industry, it's very techy. And they're pushing to release things fast. They're pushing to test things quickly as possible. Companies aren't willing to take a slow approach. And I think it might be similar for lab-based meat, with the caveat that there is a, you know, they have to go through a very complicated approval process because it's a completely unknown, different product than we've ever seen before.
He's a freelance environmental journalist, and his latest piece is in Vox.com, Nithin Koka. Nithin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Stevie Wonder and The Clash. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.